Dr. Deepak Chopra, a world-renowned leader in the field of mind-body medicine. After teaching at Tufts and Boston University Schools of Medicine, he was chief of staff at New England Memorial Hospital, a best-selling author of 12 books, including Ageless Body, Timeless Mind, and Quantum Healing. He's the executive director for the Institute of Mind-Body Medicine in San Diego, California.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor to be speaking to you. It's a privilege for me to be able to express this knowledge to you. And it's also a sign of our times that we're ready to receive it, all of us. As I look back over the last 10, 15 years, over this so-called revolution that we are calling the mind-body medicine revolution, it becomes very obvious that we have seen a sequential unfoldment of knowledge in this area. About 15, 20 years ago, we became aware, at least some of us in the medical profession, but a lot more people in the general public, that through a variety of behavioral interventions, it was possible to prevent a number of chronic illnesses. And this began the so-called era of preventive medicine. This led to another phase in our understanding of so-called mind-body medicine, and that was that it was possible not only to prevent illness through changes in attitude and diet and behavior, but it was possible to evoke the healing response from within the human body itself. That the human body has evolved over millions, if not hundreds of millions of years of evolutionary time to a package of formidable intelligence. That there is intelligence within the human body, and this intelligence is the ultimate and supreme genius which mirrors the wisdom of the universe. That the human body literally can be looked upon as an exquisite pharmacy of nature. This human body makes wonder drugs, literally. It makes tranquilizers and sleeping pills and immunomodulators and antihypertensives, you name it, the human body can make it in the right dose at the right time for the right organ. There are no side effects, and all the instructions come with the packaging. And the packaging is your own inner self. I chose to call this the era of quantum healing. But in fact, this led to yet another understanding, and we're just in the midst of that now. We're in the midst of this new understanding of the potential of human physiology, and that is that not only is it possible to prevent a number of illnesses, not only is it possible to evoke the healing response from within the human physiology, but it's possible to maintain a state of balance. It's possible to maintain an exquisite and harmonious interaction of elements and forces within this system that we call the human body-mind for an extended period of time. That human aging, unlike the aging of animals, is not a fixed phenomenon. Scientists and others have suspected for a long time that human aging is fluid. It accelerates when you're under stress. It may slow down if you fall in love. But most importantly, a number of studies in the last several years have indicated that human aging could be even reversible. The way a scientist measures the human aging process is through certain biomarkers. These are things like blood pressure and bone density and body temperature regulation, things like the fat content in the body, aerobic capacity, which is the ability to utilize oxygen, things like cholesterol HDL ratio, muscle mass, the strength of muscles, the level of sex hormones in the human body, hearing threshold, vision. These are some of the well-known biomarkers of human aging. And a number of studies have revealed in the last several years that it is possible to change all these biomarkers in the reverse direction, leading literally to an extraordinary conclusion that we know as chronological age may not be the same thing as biological age. And of course, we've known that somebody can be 25 years biologically and yet they're chronologically much older. Chronologically, they're 50 or 60, but they're physically fit and mentally fit, and you measure their biomarkers, their biological age is much younger. On the other hand, you can have somebody who's very young, who can be 25, and they're physically burnt out and emotionally burnt out, and you measure their biomarkers, they reflect the age of an old person. So human aging is fluid. It can even be reversed. And these possibilities are at the level not only of the physical body, or these interventions for reversal are not only at the level of the physical body, but also the emotional body, which we'll be talking about, and through spiritual experience. There are a number of studies that indicate that each of these interventions works independently, some at the level of the environment, some at the level of the body itself, some at the level of our psychology and emotions, and yet others through a spiritual experience. For example, a few years ago, scientists at Tufts University School of Medicine took some people, older people, some of these were between the ages of 60 and 72, but some were even older, they were over the age of 95, and they introduced them to a physical fitness program, including a gradually increasing weight training program. And after a while, when the biomarkers of aging were measured, and 10 biomarkers were measured, all of them had reversed. And some people who were actually between the ages of 60 and 72 were more physically fit, had more physical stamina and endurance, and could lift heavier weights than others that were 25 years of age. A remarkable finding, because it shows for the first time that we have to alter our whole expectation of what it means to age. An even more interesting study was done by a scientist, a psychologist at Harvard University by the name of Ellen Langer, who in the mid-80s advertised in a Boston newspaper that she wanted people over the age of 75 to participate in what can be called now in retrospect a time experiment. All these people were over the age of 75, and they were taken to a retreat a few miles outside of Boston, where an environment was created from the 50s, from 1959, as a matter of fact. And they watched movies of that era, like Anatomy of a Murder, directed by Alfred Hitchcock, A Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. They watched Fidel Castro and Khrushchev on television. They had Life magazines and other things from that, the Saturday Evening Post from that era, and all the sensory stimuli replicated the experience of the 50s. The underlying premise of this study is that sometimes a remembered experience can create the same flux of neurotransmitters and hormones as the real experience. An experience in imagination can create a flow of chemicals in your system that replicates the actual experience. For example, if you were to close your eyes right this moment and imagine that you were licking a lemon, you can try it right now if you want. Imagine that you're licking a lemon and you'll immediately see that there's the secretion of salivary enzymes. If you were to imagine that you were running after a train, it could speed up your heart rate. If you were to imagine that you were going to sleep, it would slow down your heart rate. If you were to imagine, as some yogis in ancient India and even today can do, that you have hot coals in your hand, that'll increase the temperature of your hand. And if you simultaneously imagine that you have ice cubes in the other hand, it'll decrease the temperature of your hand. If you imagine a stressful experience you've had only recently or even in the remote past, that will cause the release of adrenaline and cortisol in your system, might even generate some hydrochloric acid in your stomach and cause the experience of heartburn. So people have known for a long time that a remembered experience and a real experience can cause the same flux of neurotransmitters and the same flow or rush of chemicals in the system as the real experience. So Dr. Langer said to these people, be as you were in the 50s. And what happened? Within a week, several of the biomarkers that were studied had reversed quite dramatically, including things like flexibility of fingers, even the length of fingers, other biomarkers like hearing and vision had reversed. And this intervention did not include things like physical exercise, a change in diet, or meditation, or taking antioxidants, all of which we also know independently can have an effect on the biomarkers of aging. Our whole experience of everyday reality comes about as a result of the interpretation of sensory experience. That's how we experience the world, after all, through our senses, what we see and touch and taste and smell. And of course, we even have expressions like seeing is believing. If you can see something, if you can touch it, it has texture, it has color, then it's real, it's solid. And if you cannot experience it through your senses, then you say, well, it's not so real, it's just in my imagination. I hope to convince you, by the time we're finished tonight, that if you can see it and touch it, it's probably just an illusion, doesn't have intrinsic reality, and it's the child of something that you cannot experience through your senses, that you cannot possibly even imagine, that is non-conceptualizable, and yet more real than anything in your mind or anything that you can experience through your senses. Abstract, ineffable, mysterious, incomprehensible to a lot of people, but experiential. And we will get into what that is, because it may be our essential nature. The fact is that the world out there, even though it is enormous and huge and solid, does not have an existence independent of an observer. In other words, the physical world is literally a response of the observer. This here is the response of those who are observing this. It's a response of the observer because it is dependent on the instruments that you use to make the observation. The instruments that we use to make observations are essentially our receptors and our nervous system. And the way we use those instruments and the way we've learned to use those instruments gives us a certain picture of reality. And we think that the picture of reality is reality. But what I want to prove to you tonight is that there is a difference between reality and our perception of reality. A well-known experiment that is known to many scientists who study the field of cognition is one where scientists took some kittens and they brought them up in a room that had only horizontal stripes. These kittens were exposed to stimuli in the environment, visual stimuli, just horizontal stripes. Another group of kittens were brought up in a room that had vertical stripes. And when these kittens grew up to be wise old cats, then one group of cats could see only a horizontal world. The other group of cats could see only a vertical world. And it had nothing to do with the belief system of these cats. It seems they didn't have the interneuronal connections, which means the connections between neurons to either see a horizontal world or a vertical world. What happened? these kittens, being exposed only to horizontal stimuli, they made an interpretation. Their nervous system made an interpretation. Maybe not in English, maybe not with an Indian accent, but nevertheless, there was some process going on in the consciousness of these kittens. Everything looks horizontal, so everything must be horizontal. And then the nervous system, in fact, developed in such a way that it ended up reinforcing that interpretation. So ultimately, what they saw was their interpretation. I can guarantee you that most of what we see out there is an interpretation, literally. I'm not speaking metaphorically. It's a function of our receptors and how we've learned to use those receptors. And this is true of all living species, not just us as human beings. A honeybee, when it looks at a flower, because it cannot sense the usual wavelengths of light that you and I respond to, but is aware of ultraviolet radiation, can sense ultraviolet radiation. A honeybee, when it looks at a flower, it doesn't see the flower you and I see, even though it can sense honey from a distance. A snake senses its environment through infrared sensors. A bat knows it as the echo of ultrasound. Whales and dolphins navigate through echolocation and by sensing the magnetic fields of the earth, as do homing pigeons and other species of birds. A chameleon's eyeballs swivel on two different axes. You can't even remotely imagine what this room would look like to a chameleon. So what's the real picture of the world? What's the real texture of the world? What's it really like? And the answer is, it depends on who's looking, what kind of instruments they're using. This is a set of instruments. And when they make that observation, and what kind of questions they're asking themselves when they make that observation. It is literally a response of the observer. The picture of the world is not the look of it. It's our way of looking at it. And we have learned how to look at it in a certain way. We have looked at it until now through what I can only call the superstition of materialism. The superstition of materialism, which holds that this is a physical world and that we are physical entities in a physical world. This is the superstition of materialism. It says, trust your senses, when even common sense informs us that if anything, our senses are the least reliable test of reality. After all, our senses tell us that the earth is flat. Nobody believes that anymore. Our senses tell us that this ground we're standing on is stationary and we know it's spinning at dizzying speeds and moving through outer space at thousands of miles an hour. The senses tell us that things have a texture, a color, a form, an appearance, a color, a taste, a smell, and we tend to think this is the intrinsic nature of our objects. It's not. It's the intrinsic nature of the observer that is making the observation. So I think if we want to get to a new understanding of the human body-mind and of human potential, we have to discard our old notions about reality, which are based on the superstition of materialism. We have to forget thinking of the human body as a frozen anatomical structure. When I went to medical school, at least when I went to medical school, I wanted to know the meaning of life. That was my motivation for going to medical school. And the first thing I was introduced to was a corpse. I was supposed to understand the meaning of life by examining a dead body. And that model stays with us. We look at the human body as a frozen anatomical structure. And we look at consciousness as the epiphenomenon of this material body. That if you have thoughts and feelings and emotions and desires and instincts and drives, if you fall in love, if you believe in God or heaven or hell or salvation or damnation, all this is just a dance of molecules. Biochemistry produces this thing that we call thought. And if we just understand how these molecules behave, then we'll be able to solve our problems. Science, based on the materialistic model, has attempted to understand the mechanisms of disease in the hope that if you could understand the mechanisms of disease and interfere with those mechanisms of disease, you should be able to get rid of disease. Unfortunately, that hasn't worked because mechanisms of disease are not the origins of disease. Moreover, origins of disease are not the origins of health. Health, which is not the mere absence of disease, but in fact a state of vitality, of energy, of creativity, ultimately a higher state of consciousness. So let us look at a model that is beyond the materialistic model.
We'll continue with this fascinating exploration of our essential.
So let us try and look at the human body, which is a little beyond this materialistic model, focusing on mechanisms of disease and interfering with mechanisms of disease can, in fact, influence the outcome of disease. There's no question about this. All of medicine, modern medicine, is based on this very successful model also. It is based on the idea that if you know how bacteria multiply and you can interfere with that with the appropriate antibiotic, then you shouldn't have infections anymore. Or if you understand how cancer cells replicate at the level of the DNA and you can interfere with that with the appropriate chemotherapy, then that should get rid of cancer. Or if you understand how hydrochloric acid binds to its receptor sites and stomach walls and you can interfere with that, you shouldn't have ulcers. And this works sometimes. It works sometimes, and the materialistic model is extremely effective in the treatment of acute illness. But when we look at the overall spectrum of disease in society, we find that the materialistic model does not really significantly alter the overall incidence of disease in society, the incidence, the morbidity, the mortality. And in fact, even as we treat illness, sometimes we inadvertently sow the seeds of illness for the future. It has been estimated that about 1.5 million people in the United States suffer annually from antibiotic-resistant infections that are acquired only in hospitals. That in fact, several thousand die from these infections. Studies have revealed that we spend over $3 billion a year on treating iatrogenic infections, infections acquired in hospitals. That the number one cause of drug addiction in the world is not street drugs, but medical prescriptions that are legally prescribed by physicians. That despite the fact that more people are doing research on cancer than have cancer, the incidence of cancer has actually increased in the last three decades. A physician friend of mine remarked a few years ago that more people live off cancer than die from it. A study that was published several years ago in the New England Journal of Medicine revealed that in a university hospital, 36% of patients were suffering from iatrogenic disease, which means disease as a direct result of medical intervention, disease a person happened to have because they happened to be in the hospital or saw a physician. It has also been estimated that between 30 to 50, and in some studies, as many as 80% of the population in the United States and Great Britain and Canada swallows a medically prescribed chemical every 24 hours. So I think something is wrong with this materialistic model, which is very successful in acute illness, but it also gives us the idea that the solution to our life's problems is a magic bullet. An instantaneous solution, a magical solution that happens in the moment because you know the mechanisms of disease. As I said earlier, mechanisms of disease are not origins of disease, and origins of disease are not origins of health. If you want to understand the origins of health, we have to ask a deeper question, and that is, what is life? Life, not merely in its expressions in the human body-mind, but life in its essence, as it expresses itself in all living forms. What is life? Science seeks to define life in its expressions, in its mechanisms. In fact, recently I asked a scientific friend of mine, a physician, I said, do you have a good definition for life? And he said, yes, of course, it's a sexually transmitted incurable disease. If we want to know the meaning of life, I think we have to go a little bit beyond that. The human body is actually a river of intelligence, of energy, of information. And it's constantly renewing itself in every moment of your existence. The Greek philosopher Heraclitus once said, you cannot step into the same river twice because new water is always flowing in. And just like that, you, the real you, in a moment we'll try and figure out who that real you is, the real you cannot step into the same flesh and bones twice. Because in every moment of your existence, you're renewing your body more easily and more effortlessly and more spontaneously than you can even change your clothes. One can look at a number of physiological processes to see how literally true this is. It has been estimated that even with one breath that you breathe in, you take in 10 to the power of 22 atoms from the universe. It's a huge amount of raw material that comes from everywhere in existence and ends up as your heart cells, your brain cells, your kidney cells, and so on. With each breath that you breathe out 10 to the power of 22 atoms, and these have their origin in every cell of your body. So you're literally breathing out bits and pieces of your heart and kidney and brain tissue. And technically speaking, we're all intimately sharing our organs with each other all the time. A great American poet by the name of Walt Whitman once said, every atom belonging to you as well belongs to me. Every atom belonging to you as well belongs to me. And this is not a metaphor of poetry, it's a fact of physiology. Scientists have speculated based on mathematical calculations as a result of radioactive isotope studies that right this moment, you may have in your physical body at least a million atoms that were once in the body of Christ or Buddha or Mahatma Gandhi or Genghis Khan or Mr. Saddam Hussein or anyone else that you care to think about. In just the last 3 weeks, a quadrillion atoms, which is 10 followed by 15 zeros, a quadrillion atoms have circulated through your body that have circulated through the body of every other living species on our planet. Think of a tree in Africa, a squirrel in Siberia, a peasant in China, and you have in your physical body raw material that was floating there 3 weeks ago. In less than 1 year, it is estimated that you replaced 98% of all the atoms in your body. So on the atomic level, you make a new liver every 6 weeks, a new skin once a month, a new stomach lining every 5 days, a new skeleton, which is so hard and solid, it seems permanent, but the skeleton is a dynamic organ that replaces itself every 3 months. And the DNA, the genetic raw material of your body, which holds the memories of millions of years of evolutionary time, the actual raw material, which means the carbon, the hydrogen, the oxygen, the nitrogen, it comes and goes every 6 weeks, almost like migratory birds. So if you think you are your physical body, then you certainly have a bit of a dilemma. Which one are you talking about? I'm giving you this lecture using my 1995 model, I believe. And the last time I came to Los Angeles to give this lecture, I brought with me the same suitcase, but not the same physical body. Because the physical body is recycled earth, water, and air. It's recycled carbon and hydrogen and oxygen and nitrogen and a few other elements from the periodic table. Go to a hardware store and you can buy the raw material for about $7. The physical body is recycled earth, water, air, recycled elements. It comes and goes in the twinkling of an eye. And the expression that everyone's familiar with, that you are dust, you come from the dust, and you circulate for a little while and disappear back into the dust, is actually a literal expression. This is dust. It's made out of dust. I would like to suggest to you then a possible alternative to viewing ourselves. And that possible alternative is that we may not be our physical bodies. That which we call the physical body is perhaps just the place that our memories and our dreams call home for the time being. That we are confusing the horse with the rider. That the real me is not these molecules on which I ride. William Shakespeare, in one of his plays, uses the expression, we are such stuff that dreams are made on. Perhaps that's not a metaphor of poetry, perhaps a fact of physiology. In fact, as I look at this whole body of literature that is now investigating the field of body, mind, soul, and spirit, I find some very fascinating studies and case studies and observations emerging in this field. A cardiologist friend of mine called Dr. Bruno Cortes from the city of Chicago recently reported a case, a young woman in her 30s who just had a heart transplant, a cardiac transplant. And shortly after surgery, when she recovered from general anesthesia, she noticed that she was having intense cravings for chicken nuggets and beer. And at the same time, she was having dreams. And in the dreams, she was seeing a certain person. And this person was conversing to her, saying, my name is Timmy so-and-so. I love you. You have my heart. After she was discharged from the hospital, she went to her library, looked at the obituary columns, found Timmy. Young man, 19 years of age, had recently come out of one of these fast food chains when he'd had a lot of beer and chicken nuggets, was riding a motorcycle, had a fatal crash, and inside her body, she had his heart. He happened to be the donor of the heart. And since then, Dr. Cortes and other cardiologists are now looking at cellular memory in transplant patients. When I first heard this story, I said to my friends, if I'd heard it the first time 10 years ago, I'd probably give the cardiologist and the patient 100 milligrams of Thorazine and call the psychiatrist. But we are living in a very interesting age. We cannot afford to do that anymore. In our age,
today in 1995,
we are in the midst of what can only be called the climactic overthrow of the superstition of materialism. In fact, all our technology is built on this overthrow of the superstition of materialism. Today, if you can use a fax machine or listen to a program on the radio or watch something on television, all these technologies today are based on a very basic premise that scientists have. And that basic premise is that the essential nature of the material world is that it's not material. That the essential stuff of the universe is non-stuff. These technologies would not have been possible if scientists hadn't pierced the mask of matter. These technologies would not have been possible if scientists hadn't pierced the mask of matter to enter the world of energy and information. The essential stuff of the universe is non-stuff. What is interesting is that this is not ordinary non-stuff. It may be thinking non-stuff. If today you go to a really good physicist, a quantum field physicist, you ask her, what's the true nature of anything physical? She will tell you it's not physical. The physicist will tell you that the human body is made up of atoms. The atoms in turn are subatomic particles that are moving at lightning speeds around huge empty spaces. And these subatomic particles, even though we call them particles, they're not actual things. They are fluctuations of energy and information in a huge void. Seen through the eyes of a physicist, the human body is proportionately as void as intergalactic space. If you could see it as it really is, you'd see a huge empty void with a few scattered dots and spots and some random electrical discharges. Because the fact is that 99.99% of the human body is mostly empty space. And the 0.001% that you experience as material is actually also empty space. In other words, this whole thing is made out of nothing. Go beyond the facade of molecules, and you enter a subatomic cloud. Go beyond the cloud, you end up with a handful of nothing. And then the question is, what is this nothingness from where we come? What is this nothingness from where we all come? A great Sufi poet by the name of Rumi lived in Lebanon in the Middle East 1,000 years ago. He said, we come spinning out of nothingness, scattering stars like dust. He said, look at these worlds spinning out of nothingness. This is within your power. He said, out beyond ideas of right doing and wrong doing, there's a field. I'll meet you there. What is this nothingness? Is it just a void, or could it be the womb of creation? Is it possible, just vaguely possible, that nature goes to exactly the same place to create a galaxy of stars or a cluster of nebulas or a rainforest or a human body as it goes to create a thought? Have you ever wondered what a thought is? Have you ever wondered where it comes from? What is a thought? I would like to suggest to you that a thought is a quantum event. For those of you who are not familiar with this terminology of physics, a quantum is defined by a physicist as the smallest indivisible unit in which waves of information and energy are either emitted or absorbed. So a quantum of light, for example, is known as a photon. A quantum of electricity is known as an electron. A quantum of gravity is a so-called graviton, the basic subatomic particle in the universe that glues the universe together. But these are just labels, labels for defining units of energy and information. A thought is fleeting, it's unpredictable, it's invisible, so is a quantum. Fleeting, unpredictable, invisible. A thought is also a unit of information and energy. Every thought that you have is a unit of information and energy. If you have the thought, wiggle my toes, then that has two components. Energy, otherwise your toes wouldn't wiggle, and information, that's a precise set of instructions, which is very different from blinking the eyes. Quantum events create the manifest universe out there. But quantum events create the manifest body in here as well. Thoughts being quantum events transform themselves into space-time events that we call matter. And this is not just an idle philosophical Eastern speculation. This has its basis in science. It has been known now for almost 15, 20 years that there are biochemical substrates to the thinking process, that emotions and feelings and desires and instincts and drives and memories, they transform themselves into biochemical events. These biochemical messengers from inner space, when they were first identified, they were called neuropeptides because they were found in the brain, and they're proteins. And this is how brain cells communicate with each other, through the language of neuropeptides. It was subsequently found, however, that there were receptors to these neuropeptides, not only in brain cells, but in all the cells of the body. So when scientists started looking at immune cells, cells that protect you from cancer and infection and degenerative disorders, and even the ravages of time, scientists found that these little immune cells had little receptor sites for the same neuropeptides that are produced in the brain as a result of thought and feeling and emotion. In other words, your immune cells are constantly eavesdropping on your internal dialogue. Somebody inside you is having a conversation with themselves all the time. In a moment, we'll try and figure out who this person is, but and what their local address might be. But for the moment, I think you'll acknowledge that whoever this person is, he or she or it never shuts up. The conversation is going on all the time. Ask a good neurobiologist, and they'll tell you that the immune system is listening to this conversation. In fact, ask a good neurobiologist, what's the essential difference between the immune system and the nervous system? They'll tell you there isn't any. The immune system is a circulating nervous system. And if that wasn't intriguing enough and interesting enough, the same phenomenon occurs in the other cells of our body. Today, if you say, I have a gut feeling about such and such, you're not speaking metaphorically at all. You're speaking literally. Your gut makes the same chemicals that your brain makes when it produces thought, when it manufactures thought. In fact, you can trust your gut feelings possibly a little more because gut cells haven't yet evolved to the stage where they doubt their own thinking. So, what I'm trying to say is that this body of molecules is actually the objective experience of consciousness. And the mind is the subjective experience of consciousness. But that there is an inseparability between the two. They're the same phenomenon in different disguises. We experience information and energy, and this shouldn't be so difficult to understand today because we live in the world of information and energy. All our technology today is information technology and information technology. We experience information and energy subjectively as our mind. And we experience information and energy objectively as our body, but also as the physical world. That the physical world out there is made up of information and energy that we experience through our sensors. Our sensors are just transducers that convert information and energy into taste and texture and form and color. We, you and I, we give form and texture and color and taste and smell to that field, which is a radically ambiguous and ceaselessly flowing quantum soup of information and energy. And we experience that same information and energy here as the physical body. And we experience the same information and energy in our mind as our thoughts and feelings and emotions and desires. But it's all the same in different disguises. That's why there's an ancient saying in Vedic literature. It says, I am that, you are that, all this is that. And that's all there is. And if you understand that, then good night and thank you.
Don't say good night just yet.
If both the body and the mind are networks of energy and information from a more abstract reality, then of course, the next question is, what is that abstract field from where energy and information are generated? And I'll come to that in a moment. But what I want to do right now is to say to you that a good understanding of this inseparability between mind and matter, not only in our own physiology, but in the physiology of nature, is really crucial for our survival, not only as a species, but for the survival of our planet. I really mean that. We have gone through a turbulent evolutionary history, and everyone who's familiar with Darwinian evolution is familiar with the expression survival of the fittest. And that phrase was probably very relevant and pertinent when we lived as hunter-gatherer tribes in forests and had to be wary of predators. But now, as I'm sure you agree, we, the human species have become the biggest predator on our planet. And if we know the history of predators, we know that it ultimately leads to their extinction. So if we have to survive as a species on our planet, and we have to ensure the survival of our planet itself, we need a new kind of evolution, distinct from so-called Darwinian evolution. Jonas Salk, the great scientist and philosopher and humanist, has coined the expression metabiological evolution, meaning that we are over with physical evolution, but in a new phase of our evolution, the evolution of consciousness, and ultimately the evolution of consciousness of consciousness. Jonas Salk also should be given credit for coining the term survival of the wisest instead of survival of the fittest. And in order to have that new evolutionary phase unfold as a distinct reality in our own time, I think it is important to understand what is consciousness, what is mind, what is matter, and what's the connection between these three. Possibly there's no connection, they're all inseparably one. Many years ago, when I was first exploring the field of mind-body medicine, and a new whole discipline was emerging in the area of medicine, known as psychoneuroimmunology, I came across an interesting experiment performed by a scientist at the National Institutes of Health. The scientist took some mice and he gave them injections of a chemical called poly-IC. Poly-IC is a chemical that stimulates, at least in mice, the immune system. Then he took these mice and had them smell camphor, and after a while, the mice would smell camphor and stimulate the immune system. Other scientists took other species of mice and gave them something called cyclophosphamide, which is a toxic chemical that destroys the immune system, and had them taste saccharin at the same time. The mice would smell saccharin, and they would start destroying their immune system. Interesting situation. The group of mice smell camphor and stimulate the immune system. A group of mice taste saccharin and destroy the immune system. What's the essential difference between survival and death of these mice? Because if you expose one of them to bacteria, they'll get infections. If you feed them carcinogens, they get cancer. The others, nothing happens. What's the essential difference? It happens to be the interpretation of either the memory of the smell of camphor or the taste of saccharin. The essential difference, at least in this experimental model, seems to be the interpretation of a memory. Could this be relevant to us? It's estimated by some psychologists that the average human could possibly be thinking about 60,000 thoughts a day. This is not surprising. What is a little disconcerting is that about 95% of the thoughts you have today are the ones that you had yesterday. We literally become bundles of conditioned reflexes and nerves that are constantly being triggered by people and circumstance into predictable outcomes of behavior, and also predictable biochemical reflexes, predictable events in this body. We become the victims of our own memories. The state of outworn memories. The irony, of course, is that my tormentor today is myself, left over from yesterday. I think here's a very crucial understanding into the whole idea of how it may be possible to change biochemical, physiological, and experiential events. If these transformations in the body are the result of energy and information, and if energy and information is a result of interpretation and thought and feeling and emotion, then by perhaps witnessing this whole process, we may be able to influence the expressions of these states of energy and information. The biochemical expressions, the behavioral expressions, etc. You might ask, it's really true, I replace 98% of the atoms in my body, I'm making a new body once a year, then why do I still have the arthritis? why do I still have the same blocked arteries? And the answer to it may be that through conditioning, we generate the same impulses of information and energy, which is not merely the same thoughts and feelings and emotions and ideas, but also the same behaviors, the same dietary habits, the same sensory experience of the world. And as a result of that, we, of course, engender the same states of information and energy that transform themselves into the same biochemical events, the same physiological events, the same behavioral patterns, and ultimately the same outcomes of disease. There's a great expression in ancient Vedic science, the science of Ayurveda, the science of life, as it comes to us from a very ancient tradition, where the expression is, I use memories, but I do not allow memories to use me. Now, that's a very interesting expression, because here you may have a key to perhaps what may constitute the healing response. I use memories, but I do not allow memories to use me. You have to allow you have to use memories, obviously, otherwise you wouldn't find your way home tonight. But when you allow memories to use you, you become a victim instead of a creator. Allowing memories to use you is to be in the state of reaction constantly, and using memories to create responses that are creative in the field of all possibilities is to become a creator. It's the essential difference between what in spiritual traditions has been called bondage and freedom. The bondage is to our own memories, and the freedom is also from our own memories. I'll get into this in detail in a few moments, but I want to lay the groundwork for this inseparability of mind and matter and how it influences the state of health. Another fascinating experiment was published in the journal Science in 1980, where scientists at Ohio State University were studying the metabolism of cholesterol in rabbits. They were feeding rabbits diets that were extremely high in cholesterol, and then looking at cholesterol elevations and atherogenesis, which is hardening of the arteries. And to their amazement, they found that there was one group of rabbits that did not get the same extent of atherosclerosis or hyperlipidemia, even though these rabbits were being fed the same diet. There was, in fact, a 60% less incidence of hyperlipidemia and its complications. And they couldn't figure out what the difference was between these rabbits, till somebody found out that the technician who was feeding these rabbits, instead of just throwing the food at them, he would take them out of their cages and he would pet them and cuddle them, whisper sweet nothings in their ear. And now, as a result of this experience of love, and if you don't like the word, if it's scary, you can call it the flow of information and energy. As a result of this new experience, these rabbits, they transferred the cholesterol into a completely different metabolic pathway, making the essential difference between life and death from the number one killer in our civilization, which is, of course, as you know, cardiovascular disease. So even though it's important what we eat, it seems like our state of awareness when we're eating influences the metabolic pathway of food, a thing that science has not yet recognized. When you look at nutrition from a purely scientific point of view, there is no place for consciousness. And yet consciousness could be one of the crucial determinants of the metabolism of food itself. Another fascinating study that I came across a few years ago was in the journal Pediatrics by scientists and investigators at the University of Miami School of Medicine. And these scientists were looking at premature infants and their ability to thrive, infants born about 8 to 10 weeks prematurely. They divided the infants into two groups. In one group, they had little holes in the crib through which an investigator could reach in and stroke the baby about 3 times for approximately 15 minutes. They didn't, of course, call it stroking. They called it kinesthetic tactile stimulation, which is the Orwellian medical terminology for stroking, God forbid, call it love, but those babies that received this tactile kinesthetic stimulation gained an average of up to 49% more weight per day fed on exactly the same formula, leading the investigators to conclude that, quote unquote, tactile kinesthetic stimulation is a cost-effective strategy because you can save $3,000 per admission. They gain weight so much faster. We now know that if you lovingly touch someone, there is an immediate release of growth factors and growth hormones, particularly in babies and children, but even in adults. And growth hormone is an anti-aging hormone. It's a hormone that is known to have biological effects that reverse the aging process, even in adults. It's an anabolic hormone. When dogs lick their puppies, that's what happens. There's a condition that scientists recognize, endocrinologists recognize, it's called psychosocial dwarfism. And in this condition, you have children who are literally dwarfs. You measure growth hormone in their system, in their blood, it's very much depressed. And if you give them growth hormone, they still don't grow because the receptors do not bind to the growth hormone. Because these kids are not just physical dwarfs, they're emotional dwarfs. Take them out of this environment, put them with a loving mother or a mother figure, and touch them, and suddenly you'll see elevations of growth hormone, and the receptors will start to soak in this growth hormone. What we're seeing is the transformation of consciousness into a material thing, in this case, growth hormone. Growth hormone, a product of a certain code of intelligence in consciousness. Now there are many studies that show that it's not just growth factors, but many other biochemicals. There's a rush of chemicals, of healing chemicals, into your system just through the experience, the sensory experience of the world. But that sensory experience has to be non-threatening. It has to be nourishing. It has to be loving. Love transforms itself into these healing chemicals. You've heard that song, I'm sure. Touch me, feel me, hear me, heal me. Happens to be a fact of physiology. A few years ago also, I came across an extraordinary study which was looking at risk factors for sudden death from cardiovascular events, cardiovascular disease happening to be the number one killer in our civilization. And I said to myself, why are scientists looking at risk factors for cardiovascular deaths? Of course, we know what they are. Smoking and hypertension and high cholesterol. Well, recent statistics indicate that more than 50%, which is actually the majority of patients who are dying prematurely of sudden death from cardiovascular events, in fact, do not have any one of the standard risk factors. What was found? The number one predictor of fatal coronary events was job dissatisfaction, people who hated their jobs. And there's a very interesting concept in Ayurvedic medicine. The concept, it's in fact a spiritual law, literally. It's called the law of dharma. The word dharma in Sanskrit means purpose in life. The law of dharma says we are here for a reason. And it says this reason, at least there are three components to it. Number one, to discover the true nature of reality, to pierce the mask of matter and confront reality, not through the artifact of sensory experience, but as it really is. Because between us and reality, there's the screen of perception. There's such a beautiful expression from one of William Blake's poems, and let me see if I can remember it. He says, we are led to believe a lie when we see with and not through the eye, which was born in a night to perish in a night when the soul slept in beams of light. The first component of this law of dharma is to confront reality, not through the artifact of perception, but to confront it as it really is and recognize that it's our own spiritual nature. And I'll talk about this later. The second component of the same law of dharma is to serve our fellow human beings, to ask the question, how can I help? And the third is to express our unique talents. Because the law of Dharma says everyone that is alive has a unique talent and a unique way of expressing it that no one else has. There's one thing you can do better than anyone else on this planet. And when you're doing it, you lose track of time. You escape time-bound awareness. So I would restate the number one risk factor for death, premature death, is lack of meaning or purpose in life. The number two predictor happened to be something called self-happiness rating, whether you think you're happy or not. As a result of this study and other studies, and similar studies in Europe, an amazing statistic has emerged. More people die in our civilization on one particular day of the week, and I'm sure you can guess which one that is. Yes, and guess what time? So 9 o'clock on Monday morning, more people die in our civilization than at any other time. It's an extraordinary and stunning and unique accomplishment for which only the human species can take credit. Because I would presume that no other animal knows the difference between Monday and Tuesday. What's the difference? It's just an idea. It's just an idea. And you can't see ideas. You can't lock them up in a test tube. You can't observe them through a microscope. But ideas have been the harbingers of disease and death and devastation and war. Maybe they could be the messengers of healing as well. Even our experience of space and time is similarly self-engendered. Ask a good physicist, has anyone ever done an experiment or given a mathematical formulation for the existence of the flow of linear time? Ask a good physicist that, and she'll tell you there's no such experiment and there's no such formula. That the flow of linear time is a phenomenon that is created by the nervous system. In a universe where past, present, and future all coexist in a field of all possibilities, that the experience of linear time is actually just nature's way of preventing us from experiencing everything all at once, which is the way it's really happening. And of course, from our own experience, we know that we have a personal experience of time. If you're having a good time, then time flows. A few years ago, I took this flight from Boston to London, met this old friend of mine. We had such a good time, time flew. They told us that the flight was 6 hours, but to us it appeared, as the English expression goes, we got there in a jiffy. Forgot to eat, forgot to sleep. When we got there, we didn't even have the experience of jet lag. All these biological cycles, fixed cycles of rest and activity, all these rhythms that orchestrate digestion and metabolism, they got restructured as a result of the experience. We had a good time. And of course, you may know other people in your environment who constantly seem to be the embodiment of the expression, I am running out of time. They see the same clocks that you and I see, but for them, they're moving much faster. If you examine these people, you'll find they have speeded up biological clocks. They have faster heart rates and jittery platelets with high levels of adrenaline. These are scared platelets that are huddling together in their fright. High levels of all the other stress hormones. When they suddenly drop dead of a premature heart attack, then of course, they have run out of time. And then we meet people whose internal dialogue seems to be, I have all the time in the world. They have a slower biological clock. And once in a while, we've all had the experience, perhaps you were in love, or perhaps you were making love, or perhaps you were looking at eternity between the clouds, gazing at the stars. Perhaps you were walking on the beach. Perhaps you were listening to some exquisite music. Perhaps you were praying. And suddenly, you slipped out of time-bound awareness altogether. As when a person says, the beauty of the mountain was breathtaking, time stood still. What's that experience when time comes to a standstill? What's that experience? Abraham Maslow, the great American psychologist, stated this is a peak experience. Ancient wisdom traditions have called this the experience of unity consciousness. Unity scenery become one. The knower and the object of knowledge become one. The observer and the observed become one. They are the same thing in different disguises. It's also the experience of love, but not love not as a mere sentiment, love as the ultimate truth at the heart of creation. A great Indian poet by the name of Rabindranath Tagore once said, "The same stream of life that runs through the world and dances in rhythmic measure runs through my veins, night and day. It is the same life that shoots in joy through the dust of the earth into numerous blades of grass and tumultuous waves of flowers. It is the same life that is rocked in the ocean cradle of birth and death, in ebb and in flow, and my limbs are made glorious by the touch of this world of life, and I feel the life throb of ages dancing in my blood this moment." That's the experience of timelessness. We escape time-bound awareness in unity consciousness.
We've come to the end of part one of this intriguing look at the body-mind concept. There's much more to explore, and Dr. Deepak...